Dr. Alan Carlson to the stage. Thank you.
As a preface to my formal talk, I want to relate a personal incident that happened about 15 years ago. I was part of a team of historians who were commissioned by a prominent foundation to consider, quote, the nature of the human person. Putting me aside, the group was a very distinguished one. Two of the members had already won Pulitzer Prizes in history. Many prominent, important books had been written by this group, many academic awards. We had gathered in Washington, D.C. to discuss our individual chapters for a future group volume. One evening, after a long day of meetings and a fine dinner at the venerable Tabard Inn, we gathered around a large fireplace at the inn. The group, I need note, was all male. We were still enjoying the fruit of the vine and the products of the distiller's art when a question arose. What had been the most successful ideology of the 20th century? Which idea system had done the most to reshape institutions, alter the culture, change the way people think, and still stand at the end of a tumultuous century? Well, we considered communism and democratic socialism, liberalism, nationalism, fascism, and so on. In the end, though, we agreed with, as I recall, a collective sigh on a surprise choice. The most successful ideology of the 20th century had been feminism. Which leads to my formal talk. These seem to be hard times for the would-be patriarch. The family wage system that formerly rewarded the father as head of household has been undermined by equal employment and equal pay statutes. Title IX rules have mandated that much of the once male-dominated athletic world be turned over to the women. Fallout from the Me Too campaign has discouraged even legitimate male quests to find an appropriate mate. The Boy Scouts organization now produces neutered scouts. Ritalin tames aggressive little boys. Feminist propaganda celebrating female steelworkers and combat soldiers, alongside male child caregivers and stay-at-home dads, this material fills school textbooks. The military appears to give priority to the principle of androgyny rather than to victory. The prestige professions of lawyer and medical doctor are radically and quickly being feminized. The U.S. marriage rate stands at a record low. So does the marital fertility rate. A fair number of the men who do venture into marriage and fatherhood find themselves transformed into the indentured servants of their ex-wives. Contemporary church hymns and liturgies focus on gender justice and power games. Indeed, the one American journal openly affirming patriarchs has died. Published in the village of Willis, Virginia, Patriarch magazine aimed at, quote, nothing less than a return to patriarchy, a society led by strong, godly men. Each man should aim to be the founder of a dynasty for God, complete with a full quiver of children. Alas, circulation was probably never more than 1,000 or so, and the publisher called it quits in 2004. The aspiring patriarchs of 2018 now have no clear source for inspiration, nor guide for action. All the same, feminist analysts argue that the power of the patriarchs is undiminished. In this view, patriarchs remain clever, devious foes. As historian Heidi Hartman explains, patriarchy is, quote, a strikingly resilient form of social organization. The philosopher Gerda Lerner finds patriarchy to be remarkably adaptive and resilient. Feminist political theorist Sylvia Walby argues that for every victory won by women, there has been a patriarchal backlash in another area. She continues, patriarchy is a dynamic system. If women do win, then patriarchal forces will regroup and regain control over them in other ways. Well, could this be true? Is patriarchy inevitable? There are answers, both secular and religious. Regarding the former, the secular, I refer to political scientist Stephen Goldberg's 1973 treatise, appropriately titled The Inevitability of Patriarchy. Opposite his title page, this professor of sociology at the City University of New York quoted Cicero, Numquam naturam mos vinceret est enim ia semper invicta. Custom will never conquer nature, for it is always she who remains unconquered. He defined patriarchy as any system of organization, political, economic, industrial, financial, religious, or social, in which the overwhelming number of upper positions and hierarchies are occupied by males. Goldberg then argued, and I quote here, that authority and leadership are and always have been associated with the male in every society. Patriarchy is universal, and there has never been a matriarchy. Put another way, he declared that no society or group anywhere ever associates authority with a female when an equivalent male is available. Feminist assertions that matriarchal societies existed in the past are rubbish, he said. None of the alleged Amazonian societies has ever existed. Writing again back in 1973, Goldberg referred to politics, noting that there were then no female state governors or U.S. senators. While only 3% of the members of the U.S. House of Representatives were women, and a mere 5% of members of the state legislatures. Female mayors in cities of over 25,000 population were but 1%. Turning to economics, he held that there are still fewer women in positions of power and leadership in the financial and business world, except for those who had inherited wealth or businesses from successful men. So, how well have Goldberg's arguments from 45 years ago held up? In American politics, at best, unevenly. 23% of U.S. Senate seats are now held by women, compared to zero in 1973, while the ladies also now claim about 20% of membership in the U.S. House of Representatives. Numbers are similar up in Canada, where 28% of seats in Parliament are held by women. Women now also hold 25% of the seats in state legislatures, five times the number recorded back in 1973. Among cities with at least 25,000 residents, 21.8% have female mayors, up from 1% in 1973. Change is less dramatic, though, among governorships. Only 6, or 12%, of states are led by women. Might these numbers be reaching a new plateau of about 25%? Or will they continue to grow, perhaps reaching equality with men or beyond? Elections in 2018, with a record number of new female challengers, may provide an answer. The story is very different, though, in the realm of business. For several decades, feminist writers beat a steady drum, condemning glass ceilings and other patriarchal barriers to the movement of women into the corporate chief executive officer suites. And in truth, change came slowly. By 2007, among the Fortune 500 companies, the large publicly traded companies in the United States, only 13 of them, or 2.6%, had female CEOs. Then the number started to climb, reaching 32, 6.4%, in 2017. However, this year, 2018, a kind of catastrophe happened. The number tumbled by 25%, down to only 24. And of these, most are concentrated in one sector, food products. Companies such as Sara Lee, Campbell's Soup, PepsiCo. Feminists now complain about a glass cliff, where women are more likely to be chosen to run failing companies, where they are doomed to lose. This is certainly untrue. Business was once an all-male, all-boys, old-boys club, I'll grant that. Yet while modern, contemporary market capitalism has many flaws, and I write about them myself, it has one relevant virtue. Modern capitalism is immune to irrational ideology, be it racism, feminism, socialism, or some other. For a contemporary Fortune 500 company, there is only one measure of CEO success: the value of a share of its stock. That's it. Anything that impedes its rise must go. Anything that supports rising stock valuation is embraced. It's really that simple. If women CEOs were temperamentally and existentially superior to men in raising stock value, every Fortune 500 company would have one. Outside the domain of food preparation, however, this has not proved to be so. The 24 hours a day, 7 days a week schedule required of a large corporate CEO simply seems unsuited to the biorhythms of most women. The world of publicly traded corporations remains overwhelmingly patriarchal. This becomes blatantly obvious when we turn to the contemporary growth engine of the world's economy, the companies clustered in Silicon Valley. This is an overwhelmingly masculine world. Both the hardware and the software discoveries driving the digital revolution have come from men. This is as true now as it was at the dawn of the digital age 50 years ago. As Emily Chang of Bloomberg TV writes in her new book, with a really quite good title, Brotopia, from its earliest days, the computer industry has self-selected for men. First, antisocial nerds, perhaps the kind of boys you're talking about. Then, decades later, self-confident and risk-taking bros. Indeed. In the 1960s, it was techie patriarchs who designed the Apollo program that landed men on the moon. The film Apollo 13 brilliantly captures that time. Recall, not a single woman in the control room, let alone in the space capsule. The women were at home with the children. In 2018, it is patriarchs again who design the devices and write the code that puts a smartphone in every hand and the entire sum of human knowledge but a computer click or two away. Men are making things again, in line with Professor Brown's observation on Thursday night. Now, occasionally, some poor fellow within the trade often an Asian computer engineer untrained in the fine art of creative lying about gender, he notes the patriarchal nature of the digital revolution, only to be pummeled by the thought police. Activists now call, and I quote again, for smashing the Silicon Valley patriarchy. However, their prospects for success seem dim. Going back to the Goldberg thesis then, why this disconnect between the realms of politics and business? Why are women rising in the one but fading in the other? A possible answer actually comes from feminist writers themselves. Sylvia Wolby, for example, argues that feminist-inspired progressive reforms have been met with patriarchal counterattack. She shows how civil rights laws that opened higher education, the professions, and other jobs to women, when combined with welfare benefits, such as subsidized daycare and semi-nationalized health insurance, these produce a strange result. And again, I quote Wolby here. While women lose their own individual patriarch, that's what they call a husband, they do not lose their subordination to the other patriarchal structures and practices. Indeed, they become ever more exposed to certain patriarchal practices. Wolby holds that patriarchy has simply changed in form, incorporating some of the hard-won feminist changes into new traps for women. Another feminist theorist, Frances Fox Piven, provides the specifics. An ever-declining number of women are in traditional families, she notes. For men, this has actually resulted in a kind of liberation from their obligations under the moral economy of domesticity. Think Hugh Hefner here. He's led the men to freedom. An elite of women now achieves success as doctors, lawyers, and professors. Most women, though, wind up in the low-pay service sector. More promisingly, she notes, women have also developed a large and important relationship with the welfare state as the employees of its programs. Indeed, American women now hold over 80% of the social service jobs found at all levels of government. Piven calls this, a key phrase, public patriarchy. A recent study by Israeli sociologists of this public patriarchy actually found that advanced welfare states, especially those in the supposed feminist paradises of Sweden and Denmark, these actually, and I quote here, channel women in disproportionate numbers into feminine occupations, into feminine occupational niches such as childcare, elder care, nursing, and elementary education. The odds of a woman holding a job in a classically female occupation are actually highest in Denmark, Finland, and Sweden, with the United States not far behind. In short, the end result of the feminist revolution has been that most women still do women's work, childcare, cooking, cleaning, and so on, but they no longer do this for their private patriarch, their husband and children. Rather, they do it now for the collective, for the state, for the public patriarch. What I'm suggesting is that this may explain the determined movement of at least a majority of women into electoral politics. At the federal level, for example, 3/4 of women in both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives are Democrats. It's really hard to get conservative women to run. This is the party, the Democrat Party, which avidly supports the feminized welfare state. It is the defender of the public patriarchy, the new breadwinner and protector. Might their actions, that is the actions of women moving into politics on the Democratic side, be seen as a sort of consummation of their dependence on government, a kind of marriage to their public patriarch. Francis Fox Piven accepts this and is the best option available to women, certainly better than ties to private patriarchs. Sylvia Walby, though, retorts that while women are no longer restricted to the domestic hearth, they now have the whole society in which to roam and be exploited. Another feminist theorist, Carol Pateman, agrees. Under public patriarchy, she writes, the power and capriciousness of husbands is being replaced by the arbitrariness, bureaucracy, and caprice and power of the state, the very state that has upheld patriarchal powers. So, is public patriarchy a modest blessing or a curse? Feminists disagree on that. However, they do agree on one key point. Patriarchy has triumphed again. Patriarchy, whether public or private, remains inevitable. Turning now to religious examples, is patriarchy also inevitable? Among the three great monotheistic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the answer at first seems self-evident. All three look to a common earthly ancestor, the great patriarch Abraham, for guidance and inspiration. I'm glad that Pastor Wiley reminded us about Abraham yesterday. The Abrahamic faiths, as they're sometimes called, are by definition patriarchal. At another level, though, distinctions must be made. Christian patriarchy is different in kind from that found strictly in the Old Testament or in the Quran. The patriarchy of the ancient Hebrews, as well as that of the Muslims, actually resembles in important ways the patriarchal honor-shame codes of ancient Roman paganism. In such patriarchies, women are held to strict standards of chastity and fidelity. Men, though, are, in practice, allowed to wander sexually among servants and slaves, concubines, prostitutes, and/or multiple wives. For men, unilateral divorce is easy. For women, difficult or impossible. Jesus of Nazareth introduced a radically different sexual economy, a revolutionary marital ethic, then refined by the Pauline and pastoral epistles. Patriarchy continues in this new order. Male headship of a family is confirmed again and again, but in a radically new way, where the husband must focus on his wife's well-being. Headship requires self-renouncing sacrifice on the husband's part, identical to that of Christ for his church. The wife's submission looks to the reconciliation of all things, including marriage, to God. I think that's the message of Ephesians 5. In a revolutionary break with the whole of prior human experience, the new Christians also condemned male as well as female promiscuity. And 1 Corinthians 7 lays out an unprecedented symmetry in conjugal rights, one that elevated both the value of marriage and the status of Christian women. This Christian patriarchy also reflects the Trinity. The fellowship of love between husband and wife rests on spiritual equality, yet also involves the willing submission of wife to husband through which they find unity. In a similar way, the Son and the Holy Spirit, who with their unique roles are co-equal with the Father, find their origin and unity in submission to the Father. In short, Christian patriarchy is profoundly different from the patriarchal systems that came before or which have come since. And yet, it still falls short of feminist aspirations toward a pure equality. As the theologian Rosemary Radford Ruther at least had the integrity to admit, feminist theology cannot be done from the existing basis of the Christian Bible. Feminist Christianity must have a new canon or fail. Again, the New Testament message, I think, is clear. Leadership within the Christian church is patriarchal. Men shall lead Christian households, and men shall hold the positions of ecclesiastical, theological, and pastoral leadership. On these matters, nothing important has changed over the last 2,000 years. Every significant Christian body was and remains patriarchal in governance. In the spirit of John Adams, who remarked that facts are stubborn things, let us briefly recall the flaming obvious. The Roman Catholic Church is a patriarchy, guided by a holy father, selected by an all-male college of cardinals, and served by an all-male priesthood. The autocephalous Eastern Orthodox churches are each headed by a full-blown patriarch, that's his title, who also presides over an all-male clergy. Evangelical bodies faithful to the great 16th century reformers also remain true to paternal headship of Christian homes, a theme summarized in historian Stephen Osmond's excellent book with an accurate title, When Fathers Ruled, Family Life in Reformation Europe. An all-male clergy has also been the rule. Even among non-Trinitarian denominations, also appealing to Jesus Christ, patriarchy is the rule. The foremost example in our land is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, which claims a priesthood of all male members and a highly refined patriarchal governance structure with a living male prophet at the top. Well, the skeptic will retort, did not female preachers break out of the box in the 20th century, claiming a new popularity? Have not several important Christian denominations found direction in life with female clerics and matriarchal ecclesiastical leadership? It is true that the charismatic or Pentecostal renewal movement, widely dated to have begun with the Azusa Street Revival in Southern California in 1906, that this has grown into an international phenomenon, claiming hundreds of millions of adherents. And it is also true that female preachers, such as the iconic Amy Semple McPherson, have played a significant role in this remarkable development. Still, an objective examination of the many multifarious denominations that have emerged out of Pentecostalism again show the norm of male headship. Indeed, among the charismatic churches and denominations that date from the early 1900s when this phenomenon began, the clear trend by mid-century was already to deny ordination to women while still allowing them an evangelistic and prophetic role if they were suited to that. Now, that summary does not come from me. It comes from historian Joy Longfold writing in the journal Feminist Theology. From the beginning, perhaps the most common form of female preaching in the Pentecostal world was, and remains today, as part of a husband-wife team, where at least informal male headship commonly prevails. It is also true that several Protestant denominations have recently turned over the keys to the feminist theologians and leaders. In the United States, Episcopalian, Liberal Lutheran, and mainline Calvinist bodies have followed this path. It begins or began with the ordination of women in the late 1960s and 70s, followed by a subtle purging of male dissidents in leading seminaries and congregations, followed in turn by the election of female bishops, and finally leading to the election of female presiding bishops. How have these experiments in anti-patriarchal, or to put it more positively, in matriarchal religious governance gone. Well, even being charitable, they have by every measure been organizational disasters. I think these numbers are well known, but they bear repeating. Baptized membership has plummeted wherever this has been tried, by over 50% among Episcopalians and by 35% in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America since its formation in 1988. If you count average Sunday attendance, the ELCA decline is 45%. The disappearance of children is even greater, leading to upside-down age pyramids. Elderly folks holding on to memories of what their churches used to be like, while marriages between a young man and a young woman and infant baptisms become rare events. Seminary enrollments have fallen by 50% or more. The number of actual congregations declines at an accelerating pace. The normal pattern today is to send newly ordained women of varying ages, but all with minds filled with feminist and gender theology. They are sent out to already distressed congregations in small towns and rural areas to, in practice, put them to sleep. Actually, in caring for the aging and the weary, these women are being dispatched once again to do classic women's work. Moreover, and this is a real problem, I think, they may actually face here a real glass cliff. They are set out doomed to fail. This is clearly not a viable model for a sustainable Christian future. Yet perhaps matters are different among those Christians moving toward the old, new Benedict option. Do these intentional Christian communities reject patriarchal practices and embrace an egalitarian leadership framework? Rod Dreher's highly regarded book, The Benedict Option, does not really provide a clear answer. It's not the question he's looking at. Several of his examples of successful new communities, such as the Tipi Loci group in Italy, seem to have a core of male leaders. However, most of Dreher's examples of new Benedict communities are fairly loose or limited in structure and purpose. Homeschooling cooperatives, a group creating a new freestanding Christian school, or families deciding to live in rough proximity to each other and to a particular parish. Patriarchal governance in these settings would be neither useful nor relevant. However, the creation of intentional Christian communities is not something new. More intense or more all-encompassing versions of Christian communitarianism abound, particularly among the Anabaptists. And all of these groups base community governance on patriarchal principles, leadership by councils of male elders. For example, the Old Order Amish and the more liberal or flexible Beachy Amish and fellowship communities, they hold that, and I quote here, both church and family should reflect a divine hierarchy that positions God over all and man over woman. There is evidence, moreover, that male hierarchies are in practice actually stronger among those Amish groups which are more engaged with the world. The same principle of governance by male councils of elders is found among the Hutterites in the Dakotas, Montana, and Canada. Each community is ruled by 6 men, normally elected for life by other adult males. Meanwhile, the Bruderhof communities in New York and Pennsylvania, groups I've come to know well, and who, like the Hutterites, adhere to the practice described in Acts of holding all things in common. The Bruderhof share the same model. As one commentator phrases it, the Bruderhof still remains an Orthodox patriarchy. Interesting phrase. Governed by men, with women focused on home and children. Now, such groups are significant for another reason. These are communities showing high or even natural fertility. Natural fertility is fertility unimpeded by deliberate restriction of births. These are places where 5 to 9 or 10 children in each home is common. No longer fringe groups in forgotten corners of the United States, their numbers are now regionally significant in many places. And if compounded over several more generations, these high fertility Anabaptists, guided by firm patriarchs, may number well over 10 million souls, agrarian peoples repopulating the American countryside. And so, adding all this together, I return to my question at the outset. Is patriarchy inevitable? The common answer is clear. Yes.
We have some time for questions. So both of our speakers. I see one here, and let's start. I'll give you a microphone here, you guys.
Thank you very much for a capstone of this cultural issue. I'd like to just mention one item that, and for your comment perhaps, to indicate the currency of this issue in context of a matter that I know you're both aware of. And Professor Esselin spoke of men forming the military space, and Professor Carlson spoke of the androgenization of the military space. The issue is current and imminent at several levels. One is that the Secretary of Defense, even within the last few days, is being challenged by feminists in a letter I noticed in the news this morning from two senators challenging him on a statement that he made in responding to a question on the use of military women, and indicated that it's a very hard issue because it has to do with what sort of society we want to build. He sees it as a larger matter. That society is being influenced by professional and official bodies, even now, as the Senate has formed a National Commission on Military, Public, and the National Service to examine the Selective Service Act, to consider the addition of women for registration for the draft. This would be recommendations that they would make to the Congress, but already 2 years ago, the Senate adopted their portion of a bill that failed, recommending that immediately women be brought into this registration for the draft. So we have work ahead because the church itself remains silent, indifferently silent and consensual to the issue. So we really have a problem that's within the church. And finally, I'd like to read just one item assessing this issue by St. John Chrysostom. O ye subverters of all decency, who use men as though they are women, and lead out women to war as if they were men. This is the work of the devil, to subvert and confound all things, to overleap the boundaries that have been appointed from the beginning, and remove those that God has set to nature. So I just mentioned this to indicate the currency of the matter and the imminence of it for the church per se. For your comment.
Thank you. I don't think this is working. The comment reminds me of something that's been rattling in my mind for the last few days, thinking about these sexual issues. They're based upon unreality upon unreality. I ask people a simple question. I've never been challenged on this. I say, at what age, for instance, does a boy become unrestrainable by his mother physically? That is, he is now stronger than his mother, and of course, speedier of foot, because he's younger and more agile. What age? 11? 12? 14 at the very latest. And yet, we don't have 14-year-old boys in the military because they're not strong enough. I mean, even if they were mature enough, we wouldn't want them there because they're not strong enough. But they're stronger than their sisters, their older sisters, and they're stronger than their mothers. They, however, have the distinct advantage over their older sisters and their mothers. They're not going to stay that way. I'm glad that you linked the two forms of the insanity. I mean, well, I'm glad that you found that statement from St. John Chrysostom. This goes along with the unreality of the whole homosexual agenda. My sister, an infectious disease specialist in Pennsylvania, can tell you that you have to learn about the contra-natural practices in order to be able to diagnose syndromes that show up in the population. She's not just talking about AIDS, a whole variety of syndromes. In this other regard, we've got a whole variety of syndromes in our military that are only showing up because we're engaging in an experiment against reality. And I find that self-styled conservatives are part of this. I actually don't like the phrase, our fighting men and women, which I hear as men apostrophe N apostrophe women. It's a new phrase. It's not our fighting men and our fighting women, but our fighting men and women. I mean, come on. We don't need infantry women. The only reason for a draft is numbers to throw into the infantry, where women would in fact be worst placed. Of any place in the military where we can put them, the infantry would be the worst. I suppose, are going to have to be taught by nature, by reality, because we won't listen to common observation or history. And the teaching is going to be brutal. And shame on the church for not calling us out on this.
I have two questions, one for each of you. For Dr. Esselin, you mentioned that every man wants his son to exceed farther than himself. And then we, as the image of God, when we take that into account, I'd just like to hear your comments about what this might be telling us about God. Does the Father want us to exceed in some way that we could identify? Or what is there any implication here?
Now, you put me in mind of a passage in Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. It's in book 3, and Milton is using his dramatic form to give us Christian soteriology, mm-hmm. and also to describe the hierarchical relationship between the Father and the Son. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting kind of hierarchical relationship because it's one that reflects this natural tendency, or rather the natural tendency among men, mm-hmm. human males, reflects this sort of thing in God the Father.
Yeah.
So God the Father has revealed to the Son and to the angels overhearing this, not only that the Son will redeem mankind, which everyone wants, but that also the Son will become man incarnate. Yeah. And that strikes the angels as a shock, implicitly. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're there, they're witnessing this, and nobody can believe it. And then Milton, picking up the wisdom from Philippians, has the Father say this, because you are not going to derogate from your glory by being humbled. Yeah. Because thou hast the throne in highest bliss, equal to God, and equally enjoying godlike fruition, quitted all to save a world from utter loss, and hast been found by merit more than birthright, Son of God, found worthiest to be so by being good, far more than great or high. Because in thee love hath abounded more than glory abounds, therefore thy humiliation shall exalt with thee thy manhood also to this throne. Here shalt thou reign incarnate, here shalt reign both God and man, Son both of God and man, anointed universal King. It's stunning, and in its context needs to be interpreted in the rest of Paradise Lost, the hierarchical relationship, which is also which embraces equality, right? It's equality is the lesser thing that's embraced by the hierarchical relationship of man and woman in the first marriage, Adam and Eve. So yeah, I mean, I do think it's Christ who sits upon the throne in judgment. That's an amazing thing.
I find that inspiring.
Thank you.
Just it's as a matter of worship. Look who we are worshiping.
Yeah.
Yeah. My other question then, your last talk about the, you know, the male leadership in the Old Testament and the New Testament and in the church. And I just wonder about the fact that God called female prophets in the Old Testament, but not female priests. Does that tell us anything that you might want to emphasize?
Well, I think it does, and I think it tells us pretty much like what I was describing in the charismatic movement. Mm. There are female prophets who've been very powerful, and female evangelists who've been very powerful. Yeah. But when you finally wind up getting an organization on the ground, the common, almost universal Christian experience has been, until very recently, male leadership. Yeah. And if you get into the business of ordination, male ordination. Just one last, just a comment too about the prior question. Lord help us if our androgynous military ever has to fight a real foe using infantry troops. We will learn a terrible lesson.
My question is, I'd like to first comment on Dr. Carlson. If I may be so bold, you are listing some traditional roles of women who were supported by their personal patriarch, and now they do so under the support of their public patriarch. I think you missed a really important one, teachers. So, Dr. Esslin, you were saying that you thought that the one exceptional institution that might be good for boys would be male-dominated education. I am a homeschooling mother of 9. I do have a personal patriarch. And my first 3 were boys. I have read tons of what you have written and you have shaped and affirmed my homeschooling style. You've had tremendous influence on me, but not as much as my own father, who, like you, detested school when he was a boy, but who, like you, went on to get graduate degrees voluntarily. He has spent a lifetime critical of the emasculation of boys in school, and when his own sons didn't like school, and yet, as a senior started performing well, he quipped, "So they finally got to ya." So given that background, my 3 older boys are graduated from high school now. They're all out of the house, 23, 20, and 18. But there are other, I homeschooled them through high school, but there are other options available. There's St. Greg's. My son's best friend went to boarding school at St. Greg's.
3 miles away from my high school.
I know. And there's another school near here that's an all-boys Catholic school. Not all all-boys Catholic schools are equal. But I would think that that's not the ideal. We're talking about patriarchy in the sense of meaning father. And these male teachers are substitutes for their own, for the actual fathers of the sons. But I don't find a lot of support for homeschooling young men in high school age, even though I felt like it was an excellent experience. My boys thank me for it. But again, I did it under your more model, which is the freedom for them to pursue with vigor those subjects that they're inclined toward. So, you know, maybe to the exclusion of some others.
Well, you would find an ally in Mrs. Edison, who took her boy out of school very quickly in Michigan and taught him at home until young Tom got a job on the railway at around age 14 and then began to learn telegraphy and other sorts of things from the guys who knew it there. When you are teaching your boys at home, because you love your boys and you're glad that they're boys, can affirm their boyish nature. And you want to do that, right? You want to do that. And of course you're helped in this project by your husband who is nearby. There's one thing about the if Dr. David Pence is here, he wants me to say this. And he was here. I'm not sure if he left.
Yes, I want you to say it.
Okay. it is that it's something other than patriarchy here. It's very important. It's fraternity. That is the kind of thing that the boys, let's say at St. Greg's, enjoy, where they are forcing each other to learn things that the teachers themselves are not going to be teaching them. It's a different kind of phenomenon.
Okay, you said something in something you wrote once that was very important to me, because I did homeschool three boys.
Wonderfully.
I have a bunch of daughters, too, and I have a little 7-year-old boy who I'm homeschooling. And you would mention that boys don't do as well in school as girls do in institutional school. Well, there was a phenomena among my homeschool mom groups, and we all recognize there's something with boys where they don't have that self-motivation typically that the girls have. But what you brought to light to me, and somebody has to tell me this since I'm not a man so I can't intuit it, is that boys need to be affirmed in their masculinity by other boys and men.
Right.
And a woman cannot do that.
Right.
And I think that that's a very motivational thing, that if this thing will, this is how you affirm them in their masculinity, and that's what they drive for. So my boys would go camping in 0-degree weather in Timbuktu, which is a hard thing. But they won't sit down and do their math. Also a hard thing.
Right.
And so what you're pointing out is the fraternity. And I see that, and I see the importance and the motivation aspect of it. But you don't need to go to an all-boys school to get it. You can get it from your homeschool male peers who are also being permitted to live the homeschool. I guess I want affirmation.
I understand that a lot of these schools, for reasons of survival, will look grudgingly at homeschool cooperatives.
Yeah.
Because everybody's scrambling for money. Everybody's scrambling for, St. Greg's no less than others. And St. Greg's has barely survived. But they're now back. I mean, they're healthy. But there was a couple of years ago where they were just hanging on. That may be playing into it, too, that we really do want to believe that you've got to be in an all-boys school. However, I will say, I have written this too, maybe the things that I'm describing may not apply to every single human being. I don't want to be universal in that way. But I think we do need a lot more of all boys schools. And frankly, I do think we need some all male universities, because the university is ceasing to play the role.
You're Thomas More that you teach at now. The men who go there, the young men who go there, have they typically been homeschooled, all boys school, public school?
I'm where sure I am now?
Yeah.
A mix of that. And they are different from.
Do you think the homeschooled young men are well formed?
Yeah, I do. I used to say, even at St. Eustabes, where I used to teach, and I would meet a very large cross section of the freshmen, because all of the freshmen and sophomores had to take this Western Civilization program, right? So maybe there would be 150 kids in my section, my team's section, and I would meet these guys. And if a boy came up to me after the first lecture and shook my hand and said, "Hi, professor, my name's Johnny," my first question would be, "Did you go to an all-boys high school?" The second question would, or actually the first question would be, "Were you homeschooled?" And he would say, "Well, yeah, how'd you know?" Or if he wasn't, or if he was part of the time, he'd say, "Then you went to an all-boys high school." "Yeah, I did, how'd you know?" Because all the other boys, they don't come up and shake my hand. They aren't, and here's where equality, as Chesterton meant it, comes into play. In the masculine mind, there is an equality between that kid there and me, the professor who's got 35 years on him. In some fashion, we meet each other as equals. And he recognizes this, and he recognizes the hierarchy, recognizes former by looking me in the eye, coming up to me and shaking my hand, and recognizes the hierarchy by this act of submission and honor. If he does that, almost all the time, that is not a kid that was public school. The boys who are public schooled are sullen. You can tell it in their faces. They've endured 12 years of something contranatural. They've been beaten over the head for 12 years. They've been beaten with feminism over the head for 12 years. Some of them believe it, or at least try to persuade themselves that they believe it, others don't. But the ones who, I guarantee you that your sons would act this way to me, and I would say, "You must have been homeschooled." So I want to, I don't want
so
to make it
So it's at least on par.
But the mother is a little bit, mother who is clearly submitting to male authority in the home is a different kind of phenomenon from a female teacher in an institutional setting. They're different animals. I meet women all the time who really love the fact that they have sons. I very rarely meet a female teacher nowadays who likes boys in the class. Thank you.
We have time for one more.
Question mostly directed at Dr. Esselin, although Dr. Carlson, your talk would fit in with this question as well, having to do with what makes men and women different in the way they approach problems or the way they behave and what they are to be entrusted with. It seemed at a couple of points in your comments, Dr. Esselin, that you were saying that men were better at focusing on things and for a steady period of time, even if things somewhat off the wall, as in the case of the boy geniuses, and women less so. Women were better at dividing their attention. My experience, or at least my experience with my wife and myself, has been kind of the opposite, that I'm the multitasker who flits from flower to flower and can't keep my mind on anything very long, kind of like ADHD, whereas when she focuses on something, it is as if a cone of silence has descended around her and she knows nothing else at all. And I'd be interested, maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, or maybe you want to put a different slant on it, either one of you.
Maybe monomania is the word for it. And monomaniacs can actually flit from flower to flower. My brother is one. My brother will take up something and then be absolutely consumed with it for a period, for 5 or 6 months, and learn everything there is to be learned about it, and then flip to something else. If it hadn't been for my father, I'm sure that my brother would be in jail now for robbing banks, things like that. If you have, for instance, think of this phenomenon. If you have somebody who makes a list of the 100 greatest, whatever it is, I don't care what it is, it could be football players, it could be anything, that is almost certainly going to be male. That consuming passion for something particular and to get into every single little detail of it. I'm not really talking there about so much about things that you would actually do practically from day to day. Some of these are massively impractical. And the same male who would do that for a while might move on to something else once he seems to have exhausted that. So I don't know if that describes what you have in your home. I'm speaking in general terms, though, of what I notice generally, what in front of my eyes, but also from history, from biographies of men and women. Occasionally you get the woman who is in this regard rather like a male, just as very occasionally you get a female whose handwriting is obsessively tiny and angular, but almost always that peculiarity is male. Just as almost always the large, loopy, flowing handwriting is female. And there are probably all kinds of biological reasons for this.
Tony alluded to Darwin earlier. On the differences between male and female, the Darwinists, the evolutionists, and the Christians, I mean, see entirely eye to eye. It's just how you explain how it happened, what happened at the beginning. But the differences between men and women are extraordinary. I mean, and these are real physical differences, the hormonal differences, the differences in the way their brains work. For some reason, I haven't quite figured why this is true from a Christian perspective, but women have better eyesight at night for some reason. Maybe it's to protect the babies from wild beasts or something. And you go on through the list. Differences are staggering, and the great crime of our time is to try to suppress those and eliminate those and deny those. And again, there are variations within both men and women, as Tony mentioned. But I've got a 2-year-old grandson, a little red-haired boy, and he is already obsessed with order. His toys are all organized by type, and they are placed in precise lines. He's extremely upset whenever those precise lines of order that he's managed to put together in his little world is broken up. He's just got a new baby sister. I'm sure she's going to be disruptive of his precise lines and orders. But he's a little boy.